Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. As we are embarking on Holy Week for this year, I want to ask a question, and maybe you've been asked this yourself, maybe you've seen it posed in the media. Is it really possible that Jesus actually predicted his violent death on the cross and his subsequent resurrection? You know, throughout the last century, it was very, very common for critics of the Gospels, critics of the New Testament, to say that Jesus never really predicted these things. In fact, these are what are known as Vaticinium ex eventu, which is a very highfalutin Latin phrase that means prophecy invented after the fact. According to this argument, the early church made up these words and essentially put them on the lips of Jesus when the Gospels were composed. Rudolf Bultmann, the famous German skeptical critic of the New Testament, he once said this, quote, "Predictions of the Passion and Resurrection have long been recognized as secondary constructions of the church," end of quote. But is that really the case? Did the church make this up? Or did Jesus really say these things? Did he really predict his passion, his death, and his resurrection? Well, what passages are we referring to in the first place? Well, let's look, first of all, at the Gospel of Mark. In Mark chapter 8, verse 31, and this is, by the way, at Caesarea Philippi, it says, "He," Jesus, "began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly, and Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, 'Get behind me, Satan, for you are not on the side of God, but of men.'" And he didn't really mean to say that Peter was the devil, of course. There is a devil, but the word Satan actually means opponent as well. It's a Persian loanword into Hebrew. And so at that point, Peter is really opposing Jesus. And in that sense, he was kind of taking the side of the evil one. We see it again in the very next chapter, in Mark chapter 9, verse 31. "For he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, 'The Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise.'" Now the very next verse says, this is 9:32, "They did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him." And again it comes up, and I'm just looking at Mark right now. This is just one of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Mark chapter 10, verses 33 and 34, Jesus says, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles." Next verse, "And they will mock him and spit upon him and scourge him and kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." So there are parallels to these verses in Matthew's gospel and also in Luke's gospel too. Are there any good reasons to believe that Jesus actually did say this, that he could have prophesied this? And you say, well, of course, because he's God in the flesh, of course he can make accurate prophecies. But there are other reasons, too, that even a skeptical person, even if someone's not quite sold on the divinity of Jesus yet, you might be able to show them it's perfectly understandable and reasonable, even from a historical perspective, that Jesus could have predicted this. And my professor, Dr. Craig Evans, used to talk about this all the time. First of all, he would say that John the Baptist, the relative of Jesus, what happened to him? Surely that was a clue of what might be happening one day to Jesus if he continues on along the same line. Don't forget that Jesus supported John's mission and his message. That's why he submitted to this baptism. And in doing so, he created the sacrament of Christian baptism. It was a baptism merely of repentance. It didn't really wash away sins until Jesus transformed John's baptism into the ability to wash away sins by descending into the water. He sanctified the water. He didn't need to be sanctified himself as the sinless Son of God. But clearly with what happened to John, he recognized that there was a lot of danger, especially in the political situation, the threats coming out from Herod Antipas. And he's the same guy, by the way. He's the same Herod. He's the son of Herod the Great who killed John the Baptist. This is what Jesus said about him. Now, he was warned. Jesus was warned. Don't go here because Herod's looking for you. He's trying to kill you. And Jesus says, go and tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I reach my goal. Nevertheless, I must journey on today and tomorrow and the next day, for it cannot be that a prophet would perish outside of Jerusalem. And that's from Luke chapter 13, verses 32 and 33. So again, we have here another prediction that Jesus thinks he's going to perish in Jerusalem. Now, here's another really important passage for understanding all of this. Did Jesus think that he was going to be killed? Mark chapter 12, this is the famous parable of the wicked vineyard tenants. Now, let's take a look at this in Mark 12. And he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it and dug a pit for the wine press and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the time came, he sent a servant to the tenants to get from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. And they took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent to them another servant, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, and they had him killed. And so with many others, some they beat and some they killed. He still had one other, a beloved son. Finally, he sent him to them, saying, they will respect my son. But those tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. And they took him and killed him and cast him out of the vineyard. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. Have you not read this scripture? The very stone which the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And they tried to arrest him, but feared the multitude, for they perceived that he had told the parable against them. So they left him and went away. And by the way, they perceived rightly he was telling the parable against them. And he's comparing the religious leaders of Jerusalem, the establishment running the temple, to these wicked tenants, these wicked vineyard tenants who are killing all these people, meant to collect from them and meant to set them straight. And of course, this is a reference to the prophets of the Old Covenant. Jesus is clearly here in this parable. It's clearly him. He is the beloved son of the vineyard owner, and that's God, the vineyard being Israel. And he will be sent, and he himself will be murdered. And Jesus says that God will destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Now, that literally happened in the year 70 AD. The temple was destroyed by the Romans. God allowed it to happen in the great war between the Romans and the Jews from 66 to 70 AD. And so the control, the religious establishment, it shifts over to the church, shifts over to his apostles, the new Israel. And they're all ethnically Jewish, by the way. This isn't. People often misunderstand this parable and say God is replacing Judaism with the church. The church is Judaism, just opened up to the rest of the world, to all the Gentiles as well, with the Messiah having come. So this is exactly what is being said here, and the authorities certainly understand what Jesus is saying about them and about himself, and that's why they try to arrest him. But they're afraid because everyone was just hanging on his words. But maybe the biggest piece of evidence that Jesus did, in fact, expect that he would meet this violent death is in the Garden of Gethsemane. On the eve of his capture, his arrest, Jesus is shown to be, in Mark's gospel, very afraid at a human level about what's going to happen. And this is why Jesus prays. He falls on his face and says, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. That's Mark 14:36. So this idea of the cup is the cup of suffering, this idea of the chalice of suffering. And so there's no way in the world that anyone in the early church made this up. This is absolutely authentic. Jesus really did say this. There's no Christian, there's no member of the early church who would ever make up a prayer that makes it look like Jesus was afraid in any way or wanted to somehow get out of it. If there's another way, Father, let's do it another way. I don't want to go to the cross. There's no way a Christian would make that up. This is an authentic reminiscence. And so, of course, Jesus does do it. He does do the Father's will. But think about when you compare this with the fourth gospel. We don't have this in John's gospel. We don't have this in John's gospel at all. It's a bit of a different portrait, and we can talk about why that is another time. But the gospels say, here's another thing too, and Craig Evans used to talk about this, the gospels say that Jesus commanded his disciples to take up their own crosses, to come after him. We see this in Mark chapter 8, verse 34. Now, what's interesting about this is that Jesus is not even able to follow his own advice. Now, it wasn't his fault. He was so weakened from the scourging, the beating, he's not able to carry his own cross. And so Simon of Cyrene, this passerby, is conscripted from the crowd and forced to carry the cross for Jesus. There's no way, once again, that anybody writing the Gospels is going to make up a story about Jesus not even going to be able to fulfill his own directive to his disciples. So I know there's more to the idea of carrying the cross than just the literal sense of that, but all of this is in the background here. So it seems clear to me that Jesus did have good reason to predict that he was going to come into conflict with the religious establishment of Jerusalem, and ultimately with the devil himself, who's really behind the actions of Pilate and Caiaphas the high priest. And this is actually a pattern that's repeated all throughout the Old Covenant, too. If you look at the books of the Maccabees, in 2 Maccabees chapter 7, we have this horrific scene where these Maccabean martyrs, these seven brothers, are murdered in a grisly way, but they kind of see it as, and this is kind of portrayed as, this is for the nation. If in some way our suffering can free the people of Israel, then it's well worth it. And so Jesus was, of course, dying on behalf of the people, and the Gospels explain this violent death and its significance, but I think there's every reason to believe that Jesus, in fact, predicted it. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Okay, let's look now at the question of, did Jesus predict his resurrection? I think it's more than plausible that he did. First of all, every pious Jew, well, not every pious Jew, I should really clarify that. The Sadducees, and you can question whether or not they really were pious, because they didn't believe this. They didn't believe in the resurrection of the body. They didn't believe in an afterlife of any kind. They didn't believe in angels, demons, heaven, hell. They thought death was the end, kind of annihilationless, if you will. No wonder they were so sad, you see. They didn't have much hope. But anyways, in Mark chapter 12, not too long after this parable of the wicked vineyard tenants, it says in verse 18, Sadducees came to him who say that there is no resurrection. And they asked him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but leaves no child, the man must take the wife and raise up children for his brother. There were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and when he died, left no children. And the second took her and died, leaving no children. And the third likewise. And the seven left no children. Last of all, the woman also died. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? For the seven had her as wife. Okay, so just before we read Jesus' reply to this, it's possible that this is obviously a hypothetical scenario. It's kind of an absurd case that they're trying to present to Jesus to show how absurd to them this idea of the bodily resurrection is. And this idea of seven brothers being married to the same woman and they keep dying, it may have in the background the martyrdom of the seven Maccabean brothers. That might have been an inspiration for this line of questioning from the second book of Maccabees, chapter 7. Maybe, maybe not. But what it's referencing is this ancient Jewish law of Levirate marriage, this idea of your sons, your heirs being born, carrying on the family lineage, passing it on. This idea of dying childless was considered a great problem to the Jews in the ancient world. And so if a man died without bearing children, his brother, if he had a living brother, was to marry, quote-unquote, his widow, and try to raise up children for him so that his name might be perpetuated, his line might be perpetuated in Israel. So they think they've got Jesus backed into a corner. And Jesus says to them in Mark 12:24, is this not why you are wrong? So Jesus did tell people when they were wrong, this is not meek and gentle Jesus here, that you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. Now we don't become angels. We don't become angels in heaven. We have to remember that. He said they're like angels. What does that mean? It means they'll never die again. They don't need to be married. In verse 26, as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses in the passage about the bush how God said to him, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are quite wrong. Now, that's interesting, too, because there are a lot of other Old Testament passages that Jesus could have used to talk about the resurrection. It's way more clear, like in Daniel, the prophet Daniel talks about multitudes sleeping in the dust of the earth. Some will awake to everlasting life. Some will be raised to everlasting contempt and shame. Why doesn't he use that? Well, because the Sadducees only believed in the five books of Moses. So he's kind of meeting them on their ground. He's basically saying Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are alive somewhere with God. And for God to be truly the God of the living, he's got to raise their bodies from death. Not just allow their soul to live forever. Otherwise, death somehow has the last word. So we can look at that. We can also look at the fact that when Jesus talks to the Sadducees in Luke chapter 14 about this idea of a dinner party, when you give a reception, he says, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. You'll be blessed since they do not have the means to repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So again, this idea of the resurrection is constantly in his teaching. All pious Jews, except for the Sadducees, really kind of believed in this. And even in the Dead Sea Scrolls, now these are not Christian documents, but they were groups of Jews that believed certain things. They're a major movement in the first century. It talks about the coming of the Messiah and the general resurrection being linked together. So what about this idea of after three days he'll rise? Where does that come from? In all likelihood, it comes from Hosea chapter 6, verse 2. So it's interesting. In the Hebrew text, it says, he will revive us after 2 days. On the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. Okay, well, I think that's kind of interesting. But in the Aramaic, it's even more clear. This is what we sometimes miss out on, because in the first century, when Jesus was growing up, there was an Aramaic paraphrase of the Old Testament that was read in the synagogue. That was kind of the street language that Jesus and his disciples would have spoken Aramaic. And this is what it says in the Aramaic of Hosea chapter 6, verse 2. He will give us life in the days of consolations that will come. On the day of the resurrection of the dead, he will raise us up. Wow. So it is very clear in Hosea 6, verse 2 in the Aramaic version that it is interpreted as being about the resurrection after 3 days. So Jesus, of course, is bringing about the kingdom of God. He is clearly expecting a resurrection. The Father would raise him from the dead. And people, I don't think his disciples really understood this, because it's not quoted. This verse isn't quoted anywhere in the New Testament, but it might well have been in the background of Jesus' mind. And if they had been thinking about it, maybe they wouldn't have run away so quickly when Jesus was captured, when he was crucified, killed, and buried. So when you take all of this all together, the expectation of resurrection and all the reasons why Jesus could have predicted his passion, it doesn't make any sense to deny this. In all likelihood, there's a great case to be made that yes, Jesus really did say these things. And the Gospels can be trusted once again when it comes to the life of Christ. I'm Cale Clark. You're listening to The Faith Explained. Thanks for checking out this little look at Jesus' prophecies about his passion and resurrection. We're not finished yet. We're going to dip right now into the Faith Explained mailbag right here on Relevant Radio. Now, if you have a question for me for the mailbag, you can get it to me by emailing me at faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com. I'd love to hear from you, your questions and comments, maybe some topic ideas you'd like me to cover on the show. You can also follow me on social media on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. You can follow me there, and you can shoot a question to me on that service as well. Without further ado, let's dip into the Faith Explained Q&A mailbag right now. Okay, so today's question comes to me from many of you. I actually got several different email questions on the same topic, which was, I don't seem to see any biblical justification for the office of the papacy. Now, I should probably do maybe a longer series on this, because there's a lot we could say about it. But just briefly, let me lay out a bit of a case. Now, it's not exhaustive by any stretch of the imagination for the papacy in the Bible? Well, Peter is the chief of the 12 apostles that Jesus sets up in his New Israel, the church. Now, Peter's name is always mentioned first throughout the New Testament. Whenever there's a list of the apostles, he is always listed first. He's clearly the head of the apostolic band. And one place where you can find this, and this is really a place where Jesus, in a sense, gives Peter specifically this unique authority. It's in Matthew chapter 16, the famous incident at Caesarea Philippi. Let's look it up here together. Well, let's pick it up at verse 13 in Matthew 16. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah," and that means son of Bar, Simon, son of Jonah, "for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades, the gates of hell, shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. And right after that, Jesus starts talking about predicting his coming passion, death, and resurrection. Peter has a problem with it. And right after this incredible moment where he's given the keys and he's the rock, he is the foundation stone of the church, well, he messes up big time right away. And this is part of who Peter is. He's the weakest link in the chain, and that's why we can trust the chain. Because Christ founded his church on this guy, which shows that the power comes from God, not from human beings. But this idea of the keys is really important in this passage, because when Jesus gives them, he's giving them to Peter particularly, individually. He says, "I will give you," and that's a Greek singular "you" in the original text. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you," Peter, just you, "bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Now, this is rabbinical teaching language in some ways about authority, this idea of binding and loosing the keys. It's also a symbol of authority in another sense as well. In the Old Testament, this is really kind of a fulfillment of an Old Testament image of the keys, because in David's kingdom, and remember, Jesus is the son of David. He is the new king, if you will, who needs to set up a cabinet. In the Davidic Empire of the Old Covenant, there were ministers who did different things, and you can read about this in 1 Kings chapter 4, 2 Kings chapter 18. And there was this office of the prime minister, who was kind of like the major domo, and he was number two, second only to the king himself. And this is very, very common in the ancient world. It's a common political setup where there'd be a king and a prime minister. When the king's away on business, who's in charge? The prime minister. And how do you know who the prime minister is? Well, he's the guy who has the keys. And they actually were a physical set of keys. Maybe they were kind of phony keys, like the fake keys that you get to, you know, the keys to the city when they want to honor somebody, a famous athlete or something like that. Well, in actuality, ancient cities did have gates, and there were keys. There were actual keys that would lock the city gates. And so that's where this image comes from. And you can read about this in Isaiah chapter 22. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read it, but you can look it up on your own. This is where there's a prime minister who's doing a terrible job, and he gets kind of kicked out of his office. But what's really important to understand here is that what's important is not so much the guy, it's the office that the man holds. And so the keys are then passed on to another guy named Eliakim, who's hopefully going to do a very good job. And so this is the idea of the keys. This means that Peter is the prime minister in the new Israel, and Jesus is the king. He's got authority while the king is away. And so while Jesus is, of course, in heaven at the right hand of the Father, who's got the keys on earth? That's, of course, the prime minister. Now, the king will return, the return of the king, to quote Tolkien, if you will, or misquote Tolkien. And this is what happens here. And so this idea of the office, the keys being passed on to different successors, is an important thing to understand here too. This is what Jesus is establishing here with Peter. So that's an important passage to know. Now, even if that's all we had, that would be quite something. But there are other passages as well that indicate the papacy. Luke chapter 22, verse 32. This is what Jesus says to Peter at the Last Supper. He says, "I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren." So when Jesus knows he's going to be betrayed by Peter, he knows Peter's going to flake out, but he also knows that Peter's going to repent and come back. That's why he says, "When you have turned again, strengthen your brethren." So this idea of strengthening the brethren, strengthening the other believers, is a big role of the Pope as the source of unity in the church on earth. On Easter Sunday, Jesus has a special resurrection appearance to Peter. Why did he get a special resurrection appearance? Probably because he blew it so badly that Jesus appeared to him personally. We can see this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 5. It's kind of an ancient creed of the church where Paul says specifically that Jesus appeared to Cephas, to Peter. And then we also see this in Luke chapter 24, verse 34. What happens in John chapter 21? This is an important passage on the papacy from yet another perspective. This is the Gospel of John. And this is the famous scene where they're on the beach, they're having breakfast, and over this charcoal fire, John takes great pains to point out this is a charcoal fire. Now, why would he say that? Because earlier in his gospel, guess what? Peter denies Jesus, denies knowing him, curses him out over a charcoal fire in the courtyard of the high priest. It's the only two times in the Bible that this term is mentioned, this charcoal fire. So it's unmistakable. And Jesus asks Peter three times, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" Three times he'd said he didn't even know him. And of course, Peter gets the message that Jesus is kind of twisting the knife there. Oh, you know, it hurts. But yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And then he commissions him, "Feed my lambs, tend my sheep." He is the chief shepherd in his church, his flock. When you read the Acts of the Apostles, the early history of the church, Peter is obviously the leader. He's the spokesman for the apostles. Look at Acts 1:15, Acts 2:15, Acts 4 verse 8, Acts 5:29, Acts 10:24. You could just keep going on and on and on. And then in the letters from Peter, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, later in the New Testament, he writes from a place called Babylon. Now, is he really writing from Babylon? No, he's writing from Rome, and Rome was called Babylon at the time because of its wickedness. And he's really kind of giving instructions to priests, to elders in other communities in the church. So these are just a few reasons from the scriptures why we can say that, yeah, Jesus did set up the papacy. It's in the Bible. But we'll have to do more on this another time. But I want to remind you, you can send your question to Faith. Email me at faith@relevantradio.com or follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E Clark with an E. And I'll catch you in the next episode of The Faith Explained, 23 and a half hours from now and later today on The Cale Clark Show at 5 p.m. Central, only here on Relevant Radio.